how long we got? Where's our destination today?
I don't know. We got 20 miles to cover. Let's talk some movies. People don't know how to drive.
Are we going to get lunch on this gig? You see anything good recently?
Not really. We got a little time, Steve. Let's do a podcast.
Sounds good.
The story's told with facts and lies. I had a name, but never mind. Never mind. Never mind. The war was lost. The treaty signed.
All right. We're back. Driving around. I'm Andre Shane.
I'm Steve Haskin.
And, Steve, it's the end of summer here. We're getting to the end of summer, usually the time of year where we relentlessly bitch about how shitty the year has been for movies.
Yeah, yeah, or at least the, how the, well, I guess the year, or at least the summer.
But, yeah, it's no different this year, right? I mean, it's like, honestly, we, you know, there's a couple of films that we like here and
yeah.
there.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm leaving this summer with a more positive vibe than I did the previous summer. Last year, we famously at this time wondered if 2014 was the worst year for movies ever.
Yeah.
Ever.
Yeah.
But,
was
you
it?
Know, no, because there was a lot of stuff in the fall.
Right,
that I
the fall kind of redeemed itself.
I saw some stuff this summer that I enjoyed. But still, you know, I actually haven't gone to the movies much. What about you?
I know. I'm very much the same way. It's just nothing really is pulling my attention. Week after week after week, I'm looking for stuff to see. But outside of the very basic stuff, you know, your Marvel movies or some kind of franchise reboot, you know, it's just pretty boring stuff as far as I'm concerned. Which is why we are not even going to be talking about movies this podcast.
No,
this week we'll be talking about television again.
That's right.
And you'll remember, Steve, of course, we famously a few years ago did a podcast that I really think changed the discussion and on a national level because we postulated that television was better than movies. And now, of course, everybody
say
agrees
that,
with us. So we really were like trendsetters in this thinking in that this is, in fact, the golden age of television. And since that podcast, arguably TV has gotten only better. Both in terms of content and also in terms of just the variety of avenues from which we could watch excellent television.
That's right. There's so many more options now that when we did that, there was like Netflix and Amazon were not producing original content. And, you know, Netflix at this point, I don't know, I feel like Netflix has almost as many shows as HBO does.
Well, Netflix has kind of become a mini network, in a sense, you know, and they've been doing a fine job. There's certainly a lot of options there, so that's been very, very exciting. I got to tell you, for me personally, watching TV programs, particularly dramatic television, I'm not talking about reality TV. That's still going, and that's still just as crappy as it ever was. But I'm talking about more dramatic type of cinematic shows that really are just proliferating all over the place, and it's fantastic. I mean, there's just fantastic content out there right now, and that's what we're going to talk about today.
Yeah, and this is, in some ways, they are replacing movies, because this is where, you know, not just you and I, Andre, but America is going to see good drama.
Absolutely. And you know, what's funny is just good drama. The notion that television has had some good writing has been around. You can argue it's been around since the late 90s, you know, when HBO had these great shows and there were great network TV shows like The X-Files, for example. And, of course, that's really when the HBO started really rolling with a lot of excellent programming, starting with Oz and then going to The Sopranos and The Wire and so on and so forth. All of that stuff, of course, people have talked about ad nauseum. So it'd be more fun, I think, for us to talk about the shows that are kind of active now, as opposed to the stuff that's sort of in the rearview mirror, as it were. I will start with a show that was recently canceled. And that, to me, is a show that's very exemplary of how good television is, not just in terms of solid, dramatic writing and plotting and just the overall drama aspect of it, but also to the extent to which the shows today are really pushing the envelope stylistically. The show I'm specifically talking about is Hannibal. Now, Hannibal was an NBC program based on Thomas Harris's books, and you know, for me, when the show got canceled and all the people were kind of griping that, oh my God, we lost Hannibal and nobody's picking it up, there was a possibility of it being picked up by Netflix or Amazon, but that fell through apparently. And, you know, people were upset that the show was going away, but I took kind of a more optimistic approach, as you know, I tend to do a lot of times, as you know, Steve, I just felt lucky that we got three seasons of
a
show.
Made it that far.
As innovative as Hannibal was, of all places on NBC, possibly the most, or maybe the second most, middle-of-the-road, milquetoast network out there.
Yeah.
And that show gave us a show like Hannibal, which was absolutely crazy. It was just one of the craziest shows I've ever seen in terms of dramatic programming. Did you watch Hannibal, Steve?
I haven't yet. Based a lot on your recommendation, I need to check it out. But I have not watched that show.
Well, you know, like the subject matter, which of course is cannibalism.
Yes.
It's an acquired taste. The show is not for everybody. It's definitely not for everybody. But it is a boundary-pushing show, both stylistically. I mean, first of all, the cinematography, art direction on Hannibal was absolutely fantastic. I mean, the show looked as good as any feature film that I've seen in the past 10 years. It looked that way consistently. And there was a consistent sort of artistic mind behind this, that show, and we'll come back to this concept, of course, but, you know, what's great about television is, like, in recent years, television has become an auteur's media. So, in a sense, you know, how people talk about movies with the auteur theory in mind, this sort of
yes.
started with the early 60s, careers to cinema in France, when people started going, well, you know, all John Ford's movies are kind of related, because John Ford does them all, and all Hitchcock movies are related by Hitchcock and his imagination and his stylistic flourishes. Well, it's the same thing now happening with television, where individual showrunners are bringing their kind of unified artistic vision to a show.
And well, that's what's interesting is it is the auteur theory, but the auteur is not the director.
No.
Yeah,
no,
it's
very
some combination of it's usually either the writer or the showrunner. Now, in many cases, that person
that's
is one and
person,
the same.
Right.
Game of Thrones, for example, is an asterisk where they're very clear. These two showrunners who, you know, did not write the books upon which that show is based on, but they're shepherding it through. And I guess the showrunners are the auteurs behind it. But
yeah.
One of the interesting things I find is, along with the writers, when people like these shows, it's like there's a unifying feel to the shows that it doesn't matter a lot of times who the directors are.
Totally.
And some of these shows, you know, certain episodes are better than others, and you start to kind of, you know, a couple of people have come out of the woodwork of, oh, like there's a woman named Michelle McLaurin who directed several episodes of Breaking Bad and Game of Thrones. People started to notice, like, oh, this woman is responsible for many of these great episodes. That said, you know, and this is something that goes back, you know, to the non-glory years of television, even something like Twin Peaks, where, you know, Twin Peaks, David Lynch left that show, but the director of photography and the art director and all those people stayed. So that's why, you know, an episode of Twin Peaks that David Lynch had nothing to do with looks just like
and in many ways
he did.
Feels
yes,
like,
yeah.
like the Lynch
and,
the Lynch
and the
shows.
Showrunners are the people who, you know, while they maybe they're not lighting or working the camera, they are the people though who are responsible for keeping that unified vibe going. That so then directors, you know, a lot of film directors behind the scenes sometimes direct episodes of these shows because it's a great you know, it's like a week's work.
Yeah.
With almost nowhere near the amount of preparation you have to do to direct a movie.
Absolutely. I mean, step into a show and just do your job for a few days and,
yeah, and the whole
walk
army,
away.
The whole system's there for you.
Absolutely.
You know, it's like you got to plan out your shots and where to put the camera, but, you know, the car is ready there. So, you know, jump on in, turn the keys, and you're off and running.
Yeah, I always actually wondered about the dynamics of how that works on different shows, especially with better-known directors, you know, where you have somebody with a huge film resume stepping in and doing one episode. Like, is it really just you kind of walk into a machine and then all you have to do is just work out some camera placement with a DP and you go work with the actors, you know, and go. But of course, the actors by that point are so deeply entrenched in their portrayals of these characters. What are you really going to direct them?
I think that is more or less how it goes. Like, you get a script ahead of time and you get some say in it. But, you know, I often wonder, like, how much say do you really have? Like, are there people who will override your decisions? I mean,
clearly, the showrunner is the main boss.
Well, you'll notice, too, especially on these shows that run for a long period of time, there'll be an episode of Breaking Bad that Bryan Cranston directs, or there'll be an episode of Mad Men that Jon Hamm directs.
Absolutely.
And, I mean, the cynical side of me, Andre, is thinking that the reason these guys can just step into this role with no experience is that I wonder if those shows kind of direct themselves, you know, like, if I don't think Jon Hamm's working out exact, like, angles like, say, Scorsese does before he makes a movie. I think he's more like, yeah, I know these characters, I've been around people directing episodes, it'd be kind of fun. And he throws in a flourish or two to prove to himself he put his mark on it, but for the most part he's like, alright, what am I directing? I'm directing what Elizabeth Moss says to John Slattery.
Yeah,
you know, like,
yeah,
that's what I'm doing. And then behind him there's an army of people who are doing all of the, like, technical work of filmmaking, who know their jobs very well.
Yeah, it's a very interesting thing, and it'd be very interesting to be a fly in the wall where you'd kind of be able to observe the process of a director coming in, an experienced film director coming in, and just doing one individual episode and how exactly it works. Just in terms of, like, just the politics of it and the
yeah.
ego of it, too, you know? But getting back to Hannibal... Hannibal's a good show. I wish you'd seen it.
I've got a lot to say about the show.
You
that's
do.
Right. I'm really a strong contributor to
absolutely.
The Hannibal portion.
Well, I tell you what I like most about Hannibal, and I like, besides the fantastic performances by Hugh Dancy and Mads Mikkelsen, both are fantastic actors, and they do a wonderful job on the show. The show's got a lot of humor in it. It's extremely dark humor. Again, the subject matter is dark. What I really like about the show is the complexity of how people deal with psychological issues on that show. It's very, very unusual. I mean, it's a show that takes psychology very seriously because virtually every major character on the show is a psychiatrist.
And that's, I mean, forgive me because this would be a really obvious to anyone who's watched the show. I mean, the show takes place before, you know, Red Dragon or any of these novels, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So, my question is Lecter, so he is a practicing psychologist.
Absolutely.
In this show, right?
Absolutely.
So in addition to eating people, he has patients.
Well, very much so. Okay. Very much so. Now, as a matter of fact, the show basically begins with Lecter being brought in to babysit a particularly troubled FBI profiler named Will Graham. So... The chief of the unit, played beautifully by Lawrence Fishburne, one of my favorites, brings in Hannibal Lecter, who is at this point already way, way, way responsible for multiple murders throughout the entire East Coast area, but nobody's aware of him as a suspect yet. So he's brought in to essentially psychoanalyze the guy that the FBI is using to solve the murders. You see, so that's sort of the way the show plays out. But then it sort of develops and goes into other directions, and eventually it does kind of end up with being what we know these stories to be, which is Hannibal is now incarcerated and works almost as a consultant with the FBI in a funny
yeah.
way, except he's really not. He's got his own agenda at all times. So that's kind of like the show goes. But... again, it's very beautiful. It's very interesting in the way it handles its subject matter. It has a political agenda, I think, and that political agenda, I think, is pretty, I think it's vegan. I think that show is clearly trying to draw parallels between what Hannibal does to his victims and what we do to what we eat on a daily basis. I think that's sort of a continual subtext to the show. But the psychological thing, I think, has been very influential on other shows. Like, one of my favorite shows now that is currently going is a show called Mr. Robot. It's on the USA Network. The showrunner is a guy named Sam Esmail, who I'm not real familiar with. I'm not real familiar with what else he's done. But Mr. Robot's a unique show. And it's really, really fascinating psychologically as well, because it's one of those shows where the main character is the narrator of the show. But because the main character is so obviously psychologically screwed up and is also a drug addict and has all kinds of issues, he is the world's least reliable narrator. Uh-huh. And the show has an enormous amount of fun with that aspect of things, you know? Like, the point of view of the main character and how it actually represents and interacts with reality within the context of the show. Mr. Robot's great. It's really one of the best shows on TV. Totally unique. And if you haven't seen that, Steve, you should check it out. It's excellent. And,
yeah, I've heard good things.
Again, extremely cinematic. And that's another in a pattern of what we're talking about here, is just how wonderfully cinematic television has become.
Yeah, and going back to a show that ended a year ago, though recently had a prequel of sorts, Breaking Bad, recently Vince Gilligan was on the Mark Maron What the Fuck podcast, and he had this great story about how, you know, once they kind of established what they were doing, when they would bring in a new director, you know, to direct an episode of Breaking Bad who'd never directed it before, they would show them clips of, like, The Searchers and things, of John Ford Westerns, and be like, this is the vibe we're going for. Like, you should shoot your episode like you were doing an expansive, epic Western. And that's what everybody did. But that's, you know, it took them, he says, like a season or so to figure that out.
Yeah.
But that, so that was a little peek behind, if you're a director for hire, at least on that show, you know, the head writer and the executive producers would kind of like sit you down and give you a little bit of a, like a template.
Yeah.
As opposed to just previous episodes. But like they'd have clips of other movies just to get the entire aesthetic. But Breaking Bad was a show that I did not watch when it aired. In some ways I found very enjoyable because I watched it after any pressure to catch up was over. So then I just at my own pace, and it's really good. If anybody hasn't watched Breaking Bad yet, it's pretty damn good.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and this whole binge-watching thing is another wonderful thing that you can do now. Essentially, you know, what you end up with a lot of these series is you end up with hours and hours and hours of a continual storyline. It's kind of like watching, like, a season's worth of that stuff is like kind of watching a 12-hour movie.
Sure.
You know, and one may not have time for a 12-hour movie, but one certainly has time to break down, you know, a 12-hour movie into 12 little segments, and there's plenty of time for that.
And even if, you know, people talk, I think, almost too much about declining attention spans. People look at their phone. Nobody has patience anymore. I get that, but, you know, and I have a young son, you know, he's 7, and I discovered, especially when they were really young, that a lot of times the combination of your parental duties and or how tired you are, you know, you and or your spouse doesn't often have 2 hours to commit to a movie, especially like, you know, 3 hours. I mean, forget, you know, at this point, I'm like, you know, unless my whole family goes out of town, I'm not watching The Godfather again until my son's a teenager. And these TV shows, you can be like, you know what? I got time for an hour.
Perfect. That's
exactly
right.
Or, you know, if you're feeling it, then you got time for two.
Yeah. Or a half hour. Exactly. You have options. And because each episode is kind of a standalone little film, it works out beautifully. And, actually, speaking of Breaking Bad, you know, Better Call Saul, which is a prequel to Breaking Bad.
It is, yeah.
Is one of my favorites as well. I thought that show It had a couple of weak episodes, I'm not going to deny it. But overall, I'm really, really happy with Better Call Saul. I'm really enjoying it.
I am less happy with it, I have to say. Just because, and this maybe is an odd complaint, I almost felt like they gave us what we wanted too much.
Oh, too much of what we wanted?
Yeah, that I felt it very much was just a prequel to Breaking Bad. And I was actually hoping it would be more of its own thing. Now, I understand there are parts of it that are certainly its own vibe, but to me, the overall feel of that, and again, probably because it uses, I'm guessing, a lot of the same crew members from before, yeah, is that it just feels so similar to Breaking Bad to me that I feel a little bit like I'm seeing the same story from a different angle. And I maybe would have been more interested of, you know, like one of the things Vince Gilligan talked about before they started the show was they, you know, maybe it would be a half an hour comedy. And instead it's very much to me an hour long drama. You know, and it has funny bits.
It's lighter. I mean, yeah, it's lighter in tone.
But Breaking Bad can be very funny at times.
Very true. All very funny.
Especially, you know, the first season is very funny.
But overall, I mean, the overall, like sort of running tone of Better Call Saul is definitely lighter than the overall, you know, tone of Breaking Bad. I mean, Breaking Bad always had that sort of death thing hanging over it because
of
cancer.
I would argue that part of my issue with Better Call Saul is because it feels similar, that the heaviness of Breaking Bad inevitably is hanging over Better Call Saul. That it's all leading, you know, because it's a prequel.
Yes.
I mean, it's all leading to that.
Right.
Like, anytime you see, and it's not just Saul and Mike, but, you know, we met Tuco, who was a gangster from, and he can be a comical character, but that said, Tuco's involved in some heavy shit down the line. Yeah. So anytime you see these characters pop up in cameo roles, you're like, well, that's all, like, I don't know, it's like the Grim Reaper coming to the dinner party. And you're like,
I get you. I'm with you. I think Better Call Saul definitely, I mean, it had its high points, it had its low points. I would not put it at the top of my list of the best shows going right now, but I think it's an enjoyable thing, at least for me. I'm going to stick with it. Like, you're going to give it another chance next season, right? I mean, you're not going to check out on Saul yet, and I'm certainly not at that stage, and I thought the final episode of the season was very, very strong, but they did have a couple of clunkers in there, and I think they'll get the bugs out, and I think they'll have a better show in season two.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, it's tough to make, you know, Frasier to Breaking Bad's Cheers. And at the moment, it just feels a bit more like a disappointing solo album from a member of a band I like.
Yeah, does it feel like The Ropers to Three's Company? Is that is that what it's feeling like to you? Perhaps.
Wow, that's been a while.
That is an obscure reference. That's a reference that goes back to the early 80s, my friend. And speaking of the early 80s, one of my favorite shows takes place in the early 80s, and that is The Americans. And that's on the FX network. And, man, I love that show. That show is about like a family of undercover KGB agents living in the Washington area right around, you know, the series started in 82. They're up to 84 now, I believe. And that show is fantastic. Also very intellectually and psychologically challenging, with very interesting characters, great performances across the board. A show that continually surprises you in many, many ways, besides the obvious way that we now know that we could stick with characters despite the fact that they're basically evil murderers. And I think Tony Soprano has taught us that. That's kind of started the anti-hero thing on television. Of course, Breaking Bad kind of perfected it in a way, but now we could have shows about bad guys and stick with them and feel for them. And it's a very interesting phenomenon. And that's another thing, another area where television is far superior to movies, because movies just very rarely do justice to that concept these days. The Americans is terrific. Have you watched that one?
Of course not. Why would I be prepared for this podcast? The Americans is a show that I've come closer to watching that than Hannibal, and that I think I have the entire series like, on my DVR just waiting.
Yeah. And that is also available on Netflix or Amazon. Yeah. You could definitely catch up. And you know, it's, again, all of these shows are kind of specific enough that you can quickly get the vibe whether this is your bag or not.
Yeah, there's just an abundance of content out there.
Exactly.
I haven't made it.
It's a smorgasbord of fantastic programming, and but The Americans really stands out to me, not only because, you know, I was sort of growing up right around that time, and we were also, like, Soviet transplants living in America. So there's a lot of that aspect that I really kind of relate to. Of course, we were not KGB agents, as far as I know. My parents have not revealed otherwise.
I won't ask too many questions.
That's right. But it's just, there's a lot I really relate about that show, and it's absolutely fascinating. And the degree to which you root for these guys is interesting as well. Like, the degree to which this show can get you to root for these guys doing sabotage and assassinations and that kind of stuff. And you also root for them as parents, because they have small children who have no idea that they're friggin' Soviet spies.
Ah.
So that part is also very interesting about The Americans.
So that part could be like your life.
Yes, there are some things in my life that my kids have no idea about, but they're not real secret. It's just because they don't care.
Yeah.
Frankly. But what are you really into these days?
You know, like a lot of people, I watch Game of Thrones. I know you watch that as
absolutely,
well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's funny about Game of Thrones, Steve. Like, if somebody, like, 10 years ago told me that the most popular show in the world was going to basically be a sword and sorcery epic.
Yeah.
I would have laughed at that person, man, because that is the dorkiest genre of them all, man. There's nothing dorkier than sword and sorcery.
Yeah, and it's a weird... I've actually had a fair amount of conversations with people who don't watch Game of Thrones and want me to describe it to them, and they're like, oh, I hear it's a... It's like a realistic fantasy thing. And you're like, well, I mean, on one hand, because, you know, when people, there's disease and it's, a lot of things are filthy and people can die in horribly unpleasant, just unfortunate ways, you know, like you might just get pricked in the arm by a dirty sword and, like, that's enough to kill you, you know?
That's right.
Famously, the king was, you know, he might have been drunk a little bit, you know, he's taken out by a boar, you know, like, that said, I mean, there's dragons, there's witchcraft.
You betcha. So, oh, like, lots of witchcraft.
I'm black like, magic. Oh, realism is quite the right way. And, you know, there's this critic I like named Jason Concepcion who had a great little take on it, where he's a long-standing fantasy nerd. And he said that in some ways, the most impressive thing about Game of Thrones is that, you know, there's a lot of, like, political infighting and a lot of sex and really violence to get people to think they're watching this really cool, edgy show. But then that, you know, like, well, it's not like Lord of the Rings, you know, it's not quite that same quest thing. But then if you bury down deep, you know, there's things like Bran, the crippled Stark character, who is now, you know, enmeshed with some sort of tree wizard learning about how to be Merlin or something. And... you know, that and the invading armies of ice zombies?
Yeah.
You could argue that both of those things are, like, way more important than anything the Lannisters are doing. So, in that sense, you know, at the end of the day, this thing could all wind up just being about a hidden prince or princess who comes back to reclaim the throne.
Well, yeah, it's very much Tolkien inspired, and J.R.R. Martin will readily admit that.
Yeah.
Of course it's inspired by Tolkien,
and
like everything else.
And I was saying, and that, you know, like, not this previous season, but the season before, it kind of climaxed with the Stark people battling this, you know, army of skeleton warriors, and the guys watching it being like, man, I can't believe we get, like, urbane Sopranos fans to watch this shit, you know?
It's an amazing feat. Of all the shows we are going to talk about, to me, the Game of Thrones phenomenon is really the most surprising one because, you know, again, I just cannot believe that so many people are so obsessively into that program.
Yeah.
Around the world. It is literally the most popular dramatic series in the world.
Yeah.
In the world, people in China love it, people in the Middle East love it, people in Belgium love it.
It's so popular that you know, it's the most illegally downloaded show ever, I believe. And HBO, famously, they're kind of statement to the press about people sharing HBO Go passwords and illegally downloading the show. They more or less told the press, like, you know what, we got plenty of money. Like, you know, we don't really want to encourage you to do it, but, you know, it happens.
Yeah.
And that's...
They don't want to pull a Metallica and just alienate all of their fans.
It's a crazy stance to take to just be like, guys, we're doing okay. Trust me.
Well, yeah. It's a runaway hit. It is a money printing machine for HBO. And all they want, they need to know is how long they could keep it going. And the answer is probably not too much longer because they're now officially out of... I mean, they're running out of the original
and
material.
They
to
also
play
may,
with.
I'm a little worried they may have crossed a threshold. And, you know, one of Game of Thrones things in the early seasons was, you know, you really did not know what was going to happen. Like, major characters could die, and not just die, but die horribly and violently.
Absolutely.
And, I mean, it really was. There are scenes of Game of Thrones that are among the most shocking things I've seen anywhere in any sort of movie or TV show in the past decade.
Right.
And that happened so much that we're now at the point with that show where you almost expect that to happen. Well, and that if you go through a season without any, you know, there'll be a twist and you'll be like, well, I mean, I guess that was kind of a twist, but it's no, you know, it's not exactly a guy's head exploding on my Sunday night.
Yes, that's there's nothing like it, and there's no precedent for that in television either, because this is another thing that TV programs are doing. Game of Thrones is the best example of it, but all TV shows do it. They will kill off major characters.
Yeah.
This is something that was unheard of on television before. Even good television shows very rarely went the route of killing one of the major characters. I remember when MASH did it in season one, the only reason they did it is McLean Stevenson, the guy who played the character, didn't want to do the show anymore. So somebody decided to kill off that character. And there was like a national day of mourning when that character was killed. On Game of Thrones, a major character is whacked on a weekly basis. And I'm talking about great, great characters.
Well, one of the other unusual things about Game of Thrones is that, and partly maybe this is how they're able to get away with killing characters, is that, I mean, who's the lead? It's maybe the most true ensemble film on television.
Absolutely.
I figure anything else you can name... You know,
Peter Dinklage?
Maybe.
Arguably? Maybe.
The guy who plays Jon Snow? Maybe.
No.
I mean,
not anymore.
The Khaleesi?
Yeah,
maybe.
You got a lot of main characters.
But that's what, yeah, I mean, it's maybe the purest ensemble on television. That there are other shows that certainly have great cast, great supporting cast, but all these other shows we've mentioned, and you can at least say, like, all right, well, this is the lead of the show. I don't know who's top of the call sheet on Game of Thrones.
They filmed that show like on three continents. I mean, the top of the call sheet is whoever is like the
whoever's
head of the
continent. The biggest person on that specific
location.
Yeah.
Now they're bringing different continents together, so now it's really confusing. Now,
yeah.
like the Tyrion character, Peter Dinklage's character, is now united with the Khaleesi character. So now, no, like, who really is on top?
Who gets the best Teamster
driver? You're right,
yeah.
And I think it's great. And you know, it's chock full of great side characters as well that are fascinating and played by brilliant actors. You know, Ian McShane is joining the show. My English.
Oh, that's cousin. Right. Yeah,
One of my favorites from
buddy.
Deadwood, of course. Yeah. And you know, it's going to be fantastic. Now you're going to have another kind of name character actor who always is great to watch. Is you know,
I know we had a small run with a Kieran Hines there. It's a disappointingly short amount of time.
Yes,
Mr.
not
Hines.
Enough time
a
with
great
Hines.
Actor.
Absolutely. Well, absolutely. But you know, the show was great in many of those respects. You know, they've had the Charles Dance was fantastic on the show.
Yeah.
They of course killed him off. And you know, first season, arguably the biggest star of the show. Was Sean Bean, and sadly he met a very unfortunate end.
And I think it was season 5, but the breakout star was Oberyn. Oberyn, right? Was that his
That's
name?
Right. That's
he
right,
was
Oberyn.
Kind of the new favorite of the season.
Everybody
and,
loved him. He had a great sense of humor.
That ended poorly. And that's one, you know, I mean, for anybody who this is going to be ruined for you. You know, there's some debate about if Jon Snow is truly dead. I think Oberyn's pretty dead. I think of all the people who died on that show, that one's up there.
You could argue about Jon Snow. It's a possibility that they're going to bring him back in one form or another. But, Oberyn is definitely
dead. Oberyn is dead.
Dead. And it's too bad, because Oberyn's daughters aren't really quite...
No, really kind of disappointing on that charisma front.
That's a disappointing... that's one of the few low points for me in the Game of Thrones. Game of Thrones, of course, you know, not everything could be at 11 on any show, and on Game of Thrones you definitely have areas that are weaker than other areas, and that's fine. It works out, you know. You can't have like a big hit on every song on the album. You got to settle down a little bit in order, you know what I mean? You got to have a little peaks and valleys. That's what's happening in there. But the snow zombies thing reminds me of course the other great zombie franchise on television is The Walking Dead on AMC.
Yes.
Which you also have somehow managed to miss.
Yeah.
The only person in the world who hasn't seen The Walking Dead yet.
I've seen a couple bits, but my wife kind of turned on it, so it made it a hard Walking Dead household. So.
I understand completely. Yeah, my wife is not big on the zombie genre either. And, I have mixed feelings about The Walking Dead. Like, I watch The Walking Dead, but I also find a lot of The Walking Dead a little bit boring. I find, frankly, I'm going to just say
the walking parts?
There's too much walking.
There's too much walking.
There's seriously, like, if you calculated how much time the main character just spend walking around the forest... I don't really, like, why don't they go somewhere? They, you know, like, was a point in, I think, like, season 4, where they were like, we're walking to Washington, we're walking to Washington, and then they just stopped walking to Washington, just started walking in circles again. It was very friggin' weird. And now, there's a spinoff to The Walking Dead called Fear the Walking Dead.
Fear the Walking Dead, yeah.
Fear the Walking Dead. It's a prequel.
It sounds like a bumper sticker that AMC executives put on their cars, you know, to, like, scare off the other networks.
Yeah, I could see that. And the premiere of Fear the Walking Dead apparently was the highest-rated show in the history of the universe.
Oh, wow. Unbelievable,
like everybody wanted to see Fear the Walking Dead. I watched the premiere episode of Fear the Walking Dead, and I found it to be... like, frightfully slow. It was unbelievably, like, after watching The Walking Dead for all these seasons, with all of its peaks and valleys, Fear the Walking Dead seems deadly boring to me.
Were they not even moving? Were they afraid of walking?
Well, no, I mean, the concept of Fear the Walking Dead, Steve, is that it's a prequel to The Walking Dead.
Are there zombies yet?
Yes, okay. There are zombies. So basically, the way The Walking Dead has always kind of was structured from episode 1 of The Walking
it's
Dead.
It's after the apocalypse, kind
well,
of,
the
right?
main you are introduced to the main character, who's a cop. He is shot in the course of duty. He's in a coma. He wakes up from a coma, and the hospital is empty. And he starts kind of stumbling around, and he realizes that it's a zombie apocalypse. And so that's where The Walking Dead goes. It's a brilliant beginning, because it's shocking. You see stuff from the main character's point of view, and it's very interesting, but the world's already fallen apart.
He has to figure it out what happened.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
This is months later, and society has collapsed. Fear the Walking Dead is about the actual mechanics of the societal collapse. So it's understandably slow at the beginning, because they're trying to introduce you to various characters before the shit really hits the fan in terms of the zombie apocalypse. So it's just kind of beginning, and it's interesting. The second episode was better than the first episode, and I'm on board. I'll watch it. How long I'm going to watch it, I don't know, because honestly, I'm getting zombied out.
Yeah, that's...
I'm getting zombied out. I think I think a lot has already been said.
It might have maxed out, yeah.
Yeah, I think that, I think it's sort of...
No, I guess you could argue, since the incredible ratings of that first episode, that they haven't maxed out yet. Maybe
they haven't maxed out. People seem to be fascinated with the subject.
How many seasons are we into The Walking Dead?
The Walking Dead is like on season 6 or something like that.
Yeah.
I lose track, Steve, because, television shows are structured differently than they used to be.
Yeah, it used to very much be, you know, the new season would start in September, October, and it would end in May.
Yeah, and absolutely. And there'd be 22 to 24 episodes per season sometimes, yeah, as many as 25. Those days are over. Now, virtually every television show runs about 12 episodes. And you know what? That works.
It's,
I think it's,
it is, it's
part
better
of the reason that we are in the new golden age of television is because they're no longer pushing this number of episodes to 24, which is a ridiculous number of episodes. I mean, even at 12 episodes, Steve, a lot of these shows still have to resort to filler.
Yeah. Now, let me ask you about this, because I don't know this about The Walking Dead, because one of the things that's interesting to me, you know, the legacy of something like The Sopranos is that, you know, less like a TV show. It was more like each season of The Sopranos was supposed to be kind of like a long TV movie with chapters. So these shows would be considered almost like they have a closed narrative. And people like to assume, whether this was correct or, you know, not, that the creators of this show had like a master story they're telling.
Mm-hmm.
And every episode is just a perfectly sculpted chapter. The way if you imagine reading a novel, you know, that all the chapters are part of just one story and they're all there for a purpose.
Right.
Like you said, back when the days of network television with 22 episodes and things like that, even on dramas, that was very seldom, you know, exactly the way it worked. You know,
right,
even on...
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Even on dramas that, you know, there'd be storylines that would be advanced, and there might be an overall storyline. Like, say, a show like Buffy the Vampire Slayer. You know, Buffy was always structured that every season had kind of like a master villain.
Right.
And that was the way it would work. And you know, they'd go on, and different episodes would maybe advance that storyline more than others. But then some episodes would more or less have nothing to do with it, because they had so many episodes to fill. You know, there's just nobody had a 22-episode storyline, much less, if you imagine multiple series, you know, no one had a 120-episode storyline.
No.
Now, is The Walking Dead, is that more, like, is every season supposed to be a very defined chapter, or is it kind of like, this is the new season, and...
Yeah, it's hard to tell with The Walking Dead. I mean, first of all, Walking Dead, like Game of Thrones, is based on another medium. So Game of Thrones is based on novels. Walking Dead is based on graphic novels.
Have they made it to the end?
Well, they've deviated. So The Walking Dead comic book series is still going. It's
okay,
still happening, and it's going to go indefinitely, like most comic book series. But the show has clearly, virtually from the very beginning, deviated from the graphic novels in that, you know, characters that are still alive in the graphic novels are already dead on The Walking Dead, the TV show, and vice versa. So there's not a lot of correlation. There's a lot less correlation between The Walking Dead TV series and the graphic novels than there is on Game of Thrones and the novels. You know what I'm saying? Game of Thrones is a lot closer to the novels than The Walking Dead is to the graphic novels. But I recently heard an interview with Robert Kirkman, who's the showrunner of The Walking Dead and the creator of the comic books, and he basically said that at the beginning of the season, what they do is they sort of say, okay, we're going to go into this storyline from the comic book and this storyline, and, you know, we'll mash them up a little bit, and we're going to end up here, and then the next season's going to go into this storyline and this storyline. So they do seem to have an objective, a sort of a roadmap, you know,
okay,
but beyond that, it seems to be pretty shambling. I mean, a lot of times it seems like they're a little bit kind of lost, and at other times it seems to have a very, very specific narrative happening as an arc from episode to episode. So that's how that show works.
Well, so that contrasts with another show I know we both watch is True Detective. And True,
yes,
Detective goes to the extreme where, I mean, it's clear that the creator of that show, Nick Pizzolatto?
Pizzolatto.
Very much wants each season to be seen as a very distinct story with a beginning and an end.
It seems like it.
I mean, I don't know about you. True Detective has had two seasons now. The second one ended recently. I'm not talking about themes or style, but just in terms of characters or plot, I don't know if season two has anything to do with season one.
Yeah, I haven't noticed any connection, but, you know, sometimes it exists in so such subtle ways that you can't tell.
But nothing you can point to.
Nothing you can point to.
I mean, not even, I don't even know a case of, like, a character in season two, like, referring to, you know, like, I'm not talking scene. I'm just saying, in reference.
Well, I mean, what the season one takes place in the Louisiana area, right? And season two takes place basically in Los Angeles.
Yeah, but they do at least take place in, I mean, season one jumps back and forth between two time periods.
Right.
But the latter time period of season one, I think, is pretty similar to both that and season two, I think, are more or less supposed to take place at present day.
It would seem that, but I think that's where the connection ends.
That's what I mean. It's not, in theory, those characters are existing at least in the same timeline. You know, even
right.
They're geographically far apart.
I think you may find a connection, and I think he may, if the show survives, which is a question mark.
It kind of is.
But if the show does survive, we may find that there is an actual connection between seasons. We may discover that there's some kind of a through line or a character that
comes if he had a master, like, 3 or 5 season plan.
I'm not sure of this. I noticed this in the opening credits of season two. You know, these are the weird opening credits that are like superimposed, images superimposed on top of other images. It's kind of hard to tell what's going on. But what clearly you see once in a while are kind of like faces or eyes of various characters. And I'm pretty sure that at one point in the opening credits of the most recent season, you do see Matthew McConaughey for a second. I may be mistaken, but it looks like his face, you know, during the opening sequence. And it corresponds with the fact that he is listed as one of the producers of the show, along with Woody Harrelson as well. So maybe it's just a reference to that. But they do show him, so maybe there is some kind of a, I don't know, maybe some kind of a thematic connection. The whole thing with True Detective is like, it's not that groundbreaking in virtually any way, Steve. Like the first season of it, what made it so interesting is that it had these characters talk a lot of philosophical concepts. And that's a little bit unusual for detective shows, certainly, you know, where a lot of it has to do with philosophy and sort of philosophical worldviews of different individuals. And that, to me, made that show very interesting and kind of unique. And that's carried over into the second season as well. But I think in the second season, it was just not as effectively done as it was in the first season.
Yeah, well, the first season had a, like a supernatural overtone to it.
Yes.
And I mean, you know, they gave answers to it. The show didn't end with that they were hunting down a ghost or something.
Right, right.
But still, there was, a religious, satanic, there was an element of the supernatural around everything, which really just meshed with all this philosophizing.
Right.
You know, so like if you've got a show where you're hunting down like some cult murderers and there's strange symbols and references to occult groups, then, you know, somebody staring out the window and philosophizing about the nature of man and evil, like, it all kind of goes together. Now, one of the things with the second season is when looking out the window and philosophizing about the nature of man and evil is a little weirder when you're talking about corrupt land deals and how much your land is worth when they build the new high-speed train.
Yeah. I mean, the second season clearly was a lot more standard in terms of a detective story. What I liked about the second season is that it didn't quite have the highs and lows of the first season. Like, the first season, to me, started out extremely strong. But once the action moved entirely into present day, as it were, it got a lot weaker for me. It lost a lot of its charm. It lost a lot of its sort of intellectual drive. And it ended anticlimactically for me.
Oh, yes.
Whereas this season was a lot more uneven from episode to episode. And it sort of went up and down. And it had obviously weak elements to it. You know, it had characters that were a little bit off. You know, like Vince Vaughn who I like as an actor, I thought he was kind of miscast, or at least cast against type. And I'm not sure it entirely worked. It took me a long time to get sort of used to him in that role in the first place, because he played such a tough, you know, badass character that it just didn't jibe with the persona that Vince Vaughn has built up over the last couple of decades of film work, you know?
Sure.
But the good thing about this season that I thought is the way that the stories kind of played out. I thought it was satisfying in the way it ended. I didn't necessarily buy some of it, but I did find that, you know, the season wrapped up in a way that was a lot more satisfying to me than the first season. So I know this new season really took a lot of beating on social media and, you know, in the press for being crappy, and I didn't think it was crappy. I thought it was still very engaging and interesting, and it had, you know, weak points, but it did end on a strong note, and I think it's worth pointing out. Also had some great performances.
It sure did, and I'm with you. I liked it a lot better than kind of the vibe it got, but it also, similarly, I thought the first season was a bit overrated.
No, very much so.
I saw the second season as it was unfolding, but the first season I saw many months after the fact. And what was interesting to me is that, you know, with all these shows, these limited episode shows, again, people are looking for some sort of master closed narrative. You know, how much does what they set up in episode one, how do I feel it's resolved at the end of episode 10? Do I feel like I was taken on this great journey and where somebody clearly knew what they were doing? Now, on that front, and, you know, I will say, all the evidence is that is how the creator of True Detective wants you to take these things.
Yes.
I mean, that guy, if the word pretentious is overused a lot, that dude is pretentious.
Yeah.
I mean, like,
clearly,
in the dictionary definition of the term.
Right.
But to me, True Detective is really enjoyable in the simple pleasures of a TV show.
Yeah.
Like, the first season, you know, it had all its philosophizing, which you could get into or not, and I felt it totally punted on its big, you know, conspiracy theory
totally,
at the end.
Totally dropped the ball.
But what it is, Andre, is it was a great buddy cop show.
That it was.
And similarly with the second season, that I wound up liking the performances so much that even sometimes if I didn't like the characters or the storyline. I mean, one of the big complaints about season two, which I think is accurate, is that, you know, even going into the finale, like, if I would have a hard time explaining the central mystery of season two. You know, I had to go to, like, a website where someone, like, really, like, put it together to me, because, you know, you didn't even know who you were chasing or what. But the performances were great, and also, you know, I enjoyed the parts of season two that were terrible. Like, once per episode, some character was guaranteed to utter a line of dialogue that was so terrible, I would rewind it to make sure that I actually heard that. And you could argue that that means that was bad. That said, it was entertaining.
It was.
I mean, you know, Vince Vaughn looking with seemingly, you know, unironically saying, "The enemy won't reveal himself." It's frustrating. It's like I have blue balls in my heart.
That's the and biggest howler of the season.
It's great. Well, there are other ones too. I mean, the Taylor Kitsch's character with his, you know, when he would lower his head and be like, "I just want to get back on the bike." I mean, that
quote unquote.
Yeah. That character, I think, very intentionally reminded me of the character James from Twin Peaks, who was another guy with a similar haircut, young guy, rode a motorcycle, also maybe kind of dumb. And Nick Fizzolatto, clearly, he's got some David Lynch thing going on. I mean, Most obviously in the strange singer-songwriter woman who plays at the bar that they often hung out in. This woman who you know, plays, apparently, like, not packing them in, I gotta
say. No. I mean,
if I was the bar owner, I'd be like, you know what, lady, you maybe need to try to go elsewhere, because every night you play, we got no patrons.
Well, because they're all committing suicide. They're so freaking depressed by her material. I think of like if her set list had a couple of happier numbers in it, I think they'd get more people into that bar.
Like Julie Cruz was
considering it's the only bar in Los Angeles where you're still allowed to smoke. So.
Oh, that's impressive. That's true. I forgot about that. Well, I mean, like, in the world of Twin Peaks, I mean, Julie Cruz was, that's an odd choice of a who plays the biker bar in the Pacific Northwest. But, you know, David Lynch at least had the illusion of, like, you know, in this town, people love that stuff, that atmospheric Julie Cruise sound.
Yeah, I don't know who loves it in a live bar environment except, like, really depressed alcoholics, which, ironically, were all of the characters in this past season of True Detective. But, but True Detective, you know, it's interesting because True Detective really is an exception from what just about every other show we're talking about. Every other show we're talking about is serialized, whereas True Detective's not like that. There may be a through line. We'll see. But you know, the second season is a standalone story. So, again, you're dealing with a 12-hour movie, completely self-contained. You know, so you kind of have to judge it now just on its own merits. So second season of True Detective is really barely should be compared to first season of True Detective because it's not like Godfather 1 and Godfather 2. It's like completely different movies, you know. It's like comparing Raiders of the Lost Ark to Schindler's List, you know. Same director, but completely different stories, you know, and completely different vibes.
And there was also the effects series Fargo, which I really liked. And Fargo is, you know, season 2 has not come out yet. And is, you know, both season 1 and season 2 are standalone.
Yes.
But in season 1, the Keith Carradine character is kind of a slightly older gent who owns this diner.
And he's the father of the main character.
Father of the main character. A couple times he refers to some horrible case he dealt with when he was a police officer. And my understanding is season 2 is the story of that case.
Exactly. So there is a connection.
There is a connection.
Right,
but as we said with True Detective, I really don't know what... And it is maybe the ultimate show of power by any writer working in television now that Nick Pizzolatto is like, you know what? Me and the words True Detective are enough. Like, and people had their qualms with season 2, but in order to have your qualms, you got to watch it. And people watched it.
People did watch it, and they're continuing to watch it, and they'll watch it again. And, but you know... It brings me back to the question you asked earlier, is how much of a vision for the overall thing exists in the mirror of these shows? And I think a prime example of a show that's now completed its run that, despite my vowing not to, we will have to talk about is Mad Men. Mad Men just ended its run and had its final episode. And what did you think of that, about the finale of Mad Men?
I kind of hated it. I got to be honest. I was really disappointed in Mad Men is one of those shows. The Sopranos again set the template for this, where they realized the show was coming to an end, and rather than just have the final season, they come up with this bullshit where they split the final season in two.
Yeah.
Which, to all practical purposes for your viewing, means that it's another season.
Right.
You know, it's like, rather than a 12-episode season, you had a 7-episode season, then another 7-episode season, because they're a year apart. But so Mad Men, which was either season 8 or season 7 part 2, I was pretty disappointed with a lot of it. And my main thing was I felt... A lot of the ways the characters acted in that show, frankly, felt like a betrayal of so much of what I'd spent years learning about this show. You know, there were just scenes of, like, where Peggy got together with the other writer guy. I wasn't opposed to them getting together, but they got together in the most ham-fisted rom-com manner that I'm watching the TV, and my wife and I are like... Is this all a big fucking put-on? Because...
Is this a dream sequence?
Yeah, it just seemed... I couldn't believe it would be that just on the surface and cheesy. Just... Because that was not the whole... I don't know. To me, what I always loved about Mad Men, especially because when Mad Men started, we were still in the immediate post-Sopranos world of, like, a lot of violence. I mean, you and I have discussed, I don't know if on the podcast, but around that time there was this TV show called Heroes that came out.
Mm-hmm.
And Heroes was about superheroes, but to me it seemed unnecessarily violent. You know, this was a show that was on primetime at ABC.
NBC.
And in theory, that'd be a show you could watch with like a 10-year-old. You know, they're like, all right, superheroes, right? Let's watch the superhero show. Like Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is a show you could watch with. But then you watch that show, and characters would get executed with, like, a, you know, a revolver to the back of the head.
Yeah.
And Mad Men didn't have that.
Right.
And Mad Men, you know, to me, the quintessential Mad Men episodes, the end of it always ended on a melancholy note.
Yes.
where you're kind of staring off and the music starts. And I thought they were great. Like, I thought Mad Men shows had great endings in general.
Yeah.
And, like, what is this show that now has, you know, frantic, heartfelt phone calls running from places? And it also, I felt, I'll let you talk here in a second, but Don Draper, who is unquestionably the lead of Mad Men.
Yes.
I felt that six episodes before the end, they just didn't know what the fuck to do with them anymore. Yeah.
They did split the season in half, and I think they lost a lot of the creative momentum that that does, because literally you're taking a half a year vacation. You know, even though they're still writing and working on it, nonetheless, there's still a huge hiatus, and that hiatus really where you lose a lot of momentum intellectually for it. And I think that was exactly the case, where they came back, and the character was adrift, and he was adrift in the story as well. I didn't dislike it as much as you did. I will totally grant you a lot of what you said, and I will also say that a couple of episodes leading up to the end of the series were frankly weak and did have scenes that were a little bit silly and just did not make any sense. But the final episode, I liked the way they ended it. I was satisfied. They didn't resort to killing any of the main characters. They just kind of went on with their lives and went on doing what they were good at doing. So I was fairly satisfied with the actual finale, certainly more satisfied than I was with the infamous Sopranos finale, which just basically cut to black.
Yeah.
Even though I applaud the balls of doing that, nonetheless, it's less than satisfying. It feels like a cop-out. And Mad Men didn't do it, so to me, I was fairly satisfied with the final episode. But the episodes leading up to the final episodes, maybe three of them, they could have frankly been cut. They were unnecessary in many ways.
That's, you know, I haven't gone back and rewatched the finale, and there's a part of me that thinks, at least the Don side of it, I would hate less now that I've relaxed a bit. But, you know, at the time, it just felt like such an unsatisfying payoff to the three or four episodes of bullshit I had to watch to get to that point. Just practical terms as a viewer, I'm watching the final episodes of one of my favorite shows. You know, the final hours I'm ever going to spend with Don Draper. And I'm spending it watching him drunk and getting beat up by old veterans in the middle of nowhere. And I'm like,
in a motel room.
Thanks. Glad I put in, like, this is the climax, you know? Like, this is the final thing I'm going to remember. The taste in my mouth is Don drunk on the phone with no... I'm like, wow, this is... It's a bummer, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
That said, I will, a couple episodes before the end, see the episode of Peggy and Roger, where he gave her the erotic octopus.
Yes.
That was pretty great.
That was pretty great. It still had, you know, it still had the brilliance. It never completely lost its brilliance. It just kind of went off track a little bit. And again, I think a lot of that had to do with the actual scheduling of the show. So I think that's kind of an important aspect of the bigger picture of doing it. How long people work on these programs. I mean, we're talking about pushing a decade. That's a long gig.
I know. I bummed John Hamm out. He went into rehab as soon as it was over.
Yes, he hit a rough patch right around that time. But what are you going to do? Much like Don Draper himself. Well, that's about all we got on television, but it is, in fact, not all we got on television, because there's so many more great shows to talk about. So we'll actually be back with installment number two.
Yeah, soonish. Look at that. In an unprecedented move, Film Driven has another episode maybe almost lined up.
Yes, yes.
So next episode, we're going to talk about all these new on-demand shows, right? Yeah. What it's like to watch those things.
Absolutely, absolutely. All right. Well, we're done for this one.
That's right.
See you soon, Steve. We're Film Driven.
All right.